You can subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for only £12 for our print and online editions, plus get 6 months of digital access free to The Telegraph. Go to spectator.co.uk/telegraph.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, Spectator Life's food and drink podcast. I'm Olivia Potts.
And I'm Laura Prendergast.
And today we are delighted to be joined by Ian Rankin. Ian Rankin is the UK's number one best-selling crime writer and the author of the much-loved Inspector Rebus novels. He's written over 40 novels, stage plays and short stories and has been showered with awards, was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and has also been awarded an ABE. His latest Rebus thriller, A Song for the Dark Times, is available now. Ian, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello.
Ian, we always start at the beginning. Can you start by telling us what your earliest memories of food were when you were a child?
Earliest memories of food would be my mum's home cooking. If you go back far enough into my youth, my mum mostly was a housewife, and there were always home-cooked meals. I'd go home from primary school at lunchtime to a home-cooked meal, and there were always dinners around the table. Quite early in Scotland, working-class folk in Scotland tend to eat tea, as we called it. We didn't call it dinner, we called it tea. Dinner was what you had at lunchtime, and tea was what you had at tea time, so 5 o'clock, 5:30. And yeah, four of us, me, my sister, mum and dad, all sitting around a fairly cramped drop-leaf table in the kitchen.
Was your mum a good cook?
Oh yeah, of course, everybody's mum is the best cook in the world. My mum was born and brought up in Yorkshire, and so lots of heavy, meaty dishes, lots of stews and mince and roast beef, roast chicken sometimes on a Sunday, great soups, big vats of soup, fantastic homemade rice pudding with a skin on top that was always the best. Oh, yeah. And these amazing Yorkshire puddings. I mean, she did fantastic Yorkshire puddings, which, I mean, I've never tasted the like since. And she, before I went to university, just to fast forward a little bit, my mum thought, you know, I'm the first member of the family to go to university. She said, I better, she'll, you know, teach Ian how to cook. Mm-hmm. And she taught me how to cook an entire sort of, you know, piece of beef, you know, a sort of 2 pound, 1 kilo cut of beef. So she showed me how to cook that on top of a stove. And I think she taught me how to make scotch broth or vegetable soup. And that was about it. It wasn't great preparation for student life, I've got to.
I was going to say, that is impressive student cooking, if that's what you went on to do.
Well, of course I didn't. I mean, I've never, it was called a silver side, this cut of beef, which was basically a huge slab of beef that you did in a pot on top of the stove, and you sort of braised it to start with, and then you added sort of water and stock, and you just cooked it on top of the stove. I've never done that since leaving home. Never cooked that, but it's still there. I can still, you know, 40 odd years later, I can still remember the recipe.
And am I right in thinking that your father, James, he owned a grocery shop?
He didn't own a grocery shop. He worked for a chain of grocers, like any small chain of grocers in Fife.
And did that have an influence on how you ate? Was there food bought back from the grocery store?
Yeah, I mean, what I remember most about my dad bringing food back was chocolate biscuits. A complete box of chocolate biscuits would be dropped, in inverted commas, and therefore couldn't be sold, and it would come home with my dad. And so Jacob's Club biscuits, whole boxes of them, and we were rationed to one each per day. And so it was that kind of stuff. And yeah, I mean, he would bring home, in fact, I used to go there sometimes after school when I was young, and hang out in the shop. And, you know, it was almost like a kind of proper grocer's come delicatessen. There was a butchery section. He would slice bacon for people. There was fruit and veg, and then there were tins and lots of chocolate bars that I would gaze at longingly.
And what about school food? Did you take school lunches, or were you fed there? How did that work for you?
At primary school, yep, we had school lunches, and it was pretty vile as far as I remember. And it was such a treat at high school, suddenly at the age of 12, to go to high school, where the canteen served chips. So instead of lumpy mashed potato, say farewell to lumpy mashed potato and say hello to home-cooked chips. And I guess they were frozen. I don't know if they were frozen or not, but it just seemed like such a treat to get things like fish fingers and chips for your school lunch. But very soon after that, you know, we teenagers decided that, no, we didn't want to stay in the canteen and eat lunch. We wanted to go out, hit the town and go to the baker's and get sausage rolls and pies and stuff like that and packets of crisps and bottles of fizzy juice and just walk around the pavement eating as we went.
And once you got to university, you went to university in Edinburgh. If you weren't cooking the Silverside beef, what sorts of things were you eating? And, I mean, was that where you then had your first drink, or had you had a drink before university?
Oh, I'd been drinking since age of 14 or 15. I was getting served in pubs. I was getting into egg certificate movies at 15 because I was quite tall. And I was getting into pubs from about 15. My dad took me for my first official drink on my 18th birthday to his pub that he used in Cardenden, where I grew up, and the barman said to me, the usual, Ian, because I just made sure I didn't go into that pub on the nights that my dad went in. Yeah, so I got to Edinburgh University at 18, hung out with lots of friends from school. A bunch of us all ended up at Edinburgh Uni, and it was, you know, it was student stuff. I wasn't in a hall of residence. There was a housing crisis, as usual, so I wasn't allowed a place in a hall of residence, and I was determined I wasn't going to stay at home and commute. So I started life in a motel, sharing a room with a school friend of mine. The motel was full of university students, and then during the university break, it would turn back into a proper motel again. So you get a cooked breakfast in the morning, and then in the evening, it was, you know, fish and chips. It was baked potatoes from the... There was a whole bunch of baked potato shops around that time, and it's very exotic to have a baked potato with garlic butter. So that was the beginning of my affair with continental cuisine. The first taste of garlic I ever had was the garlic butter that came with the baked potato. And you'd have coronation chicken as a topping, or you just have, if you were skint and you couldn't afford coronation chicken, you would have something like just grated cheese or something. Not much cooking was going on. Vesta curries were a thing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would get these little Vesta curries, these little packets of space age food.
The boil in the bag ones.
Absolutely. Everything was dehydrated. These teeny tiny prawns. There'd be a little bag of teeny tiny prawns, a little boil in the bag rice, a little bag of sauce that you heated up. And, you know, it tasted exotic to me. And then there was an older guy that we shared with eventually in a flat, and he introduced me to an Indian restaurant. We went and ate Indian food for the first time. For me, the first time. And that was a revelation. And after that, if I could afford it, Indian food was my go-to.
And you've had a range of unusual and often sort of food or drink-based jobs prior to becoming the novelist that we now know and love. Is it right you were a swineherd at one point?
Yeah. When I left uni in 1982, my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, Miranda, she had gone off to France to work on a vineyard that was owned by a couple of kind of Berkeley dropouts from the 50s who had reinvented themselves and ran this almost commune. And it was a little vineyard near Castillon-la-Bataille. And attached it was a very small farm. So my girlfriend and I, our job was looking after the two pigs. So that makes me a swineherd. But, you know, because there was a farm attached to it, we would be looking after the geese. We would be spraying the potato harvest for Colorado beetle. We were also, of course, looking after the grapes and eventually pressing the grapes. So, yeah, that was a steep learning curve for me, and also an introduction to a range of exotic foods and, you know, farmers' markets. We'd have to go into the market in Castillon with a shopping list to buy, you know, everything that a party of 16 hungry people would need who were otherwise working on the farm or the vineyard.
And did you pick up any kind of tips back then about French cooking?
The thing I remember was that when there wasn't much money around, what the owner, Fox was the name she went by, what she liked to cook was can you crush up some garlic and some walnuts and make a kind of pesto, and just have pesto with lots of pasta. And, you know, I got a bit fed up having that every day, every evening for a week. But now I can't get enough of it. I think there's nothing nicer than a bowl of fresh pasta and pesto. But, yeah, I was introduced to lots of things. We had squid. I'd never eaten squid before. Fox was a great one for Mexican food. And if we were ever passing through, say we'd been back to the UK and we were heading back to the vineyard, passing through Paris, there was one shop in Paris where we could get things like harissa and corn flour for making tacos and all that kind of stuff. And we would have to bring these exotic ingredients back with us to the vineyard. We stayed there for 6 months, my girlfriend and I. On and off, we were there for 6 months. And we kept in touch with them. And eventually, when we went and lived in France, one of the reasons we went and moved to France from London was because we just loved the people we had met in France.
And now, as a grown-up, I suppose, do you cook a lot now? Are you a good cook? Do you enjoy it?
I am still a student chef at heart. I can make a mean chili, I can make a pretty good spaghetti bolognese. My wife is a great cook, and so she does most of the cooking. But we just got this new Jamie book, the new Jamie Oliver book, which is pretty straightforward. And I've cooked a few things from that. I cooked his butter chicken a couple of nights back. And that's pretty idiot-proof and doesn't require an awful lot of prep. And most of it can be done in one baking tin or one pot. So that's my kind of cooking. I hate a lot of mess. I'm a bit OCD. So the idea of the kitchen being strewn with half-used utensils and pots and pans is anathema to me.
So you haven't got into sourdough during lockdown?
You know what? No. Miranda did a little bit. Miranda got into cooking bread, as did most middle-class lockdownees. But we realised we were putting on so much weight at the start of lockdown that, in fact, we knocked that on the head. And I've been dieting pretty successfully for quite a while now. And the diet, you know, is one of these ones where you cut out bread, pasta, rice, etc. Starchy things, basically. So, yeah, so I'm porridge for breakfast every day is my go-to with lots of fresh
berries. That's very Scottish.
Very Scottish.
Well, yeah, but it's quite... I mean, my dad ate porridge with salt in it. He added salt rather than sugar.
I put salt in my porridge.
Really? Oh, no, I've not gone to that. No, I like it sweet. I like it sweet, so... berry season was fantastic. You could go to the local farmer's market in Edinburgh and get lots of black berries and raspberries and strawberries. And I would just load that into the porridge of a morning. And then that would do me pretty much all day.
Delicious. And how about when you're writing in? Do you have certain culinary habits that you turn to when you're sitting down to write the latest novel?
Well, you know, I'm a chocolate fiend, and it used to be I was powered by Snickers bars, or marathons as I call them, having grown up in the 60s and 70s. And my wife would buy 5 packs because that was a cheaper alternative, until she realised if she bought 5, I would eat 5 a day. And I'd have no memory. It's a bit like a smoker. I'm a bit like a smoker. I would have no memory of eating all these chocolate bars. It would just be the wrappers at the end of the working day. And of course, so come the diet, that all had to get knocked on the head. So what I do now is I've got San Pellegrino with grapefruit is my kind of go-to, and that's my sweetness. That's what I go to for a little bit of sweetness during the day. Or chewing gum. I started, again, almost like a reformed smoker.
Yeah, like
a reformed smoker. Airwaves chewing gum. I go through about a pack of that a day. So I'm still getting a kind of sweetness kick without actually piling on the pounds. I'm just going to take a sip from my San Pellegrino.
Just for authenticity. And you've lived in Edinburgh for quite a long time now, and obviously grew up there before that. How, we know the food scene has changed hugely in Edinburgh over the last 30 years. What's your experience been of that?
Oh, I mean, huge. When I arrived in Edinburgh aged 18 to go to university, there was not much in the way of fine dining. There were sort of fine hotels where fine dining could be had in our dining room, but that wasn't available to most of us. There were a few kind of standby Chinese, Indian restaurants, Italian restaurants, and that was about it. And then, you know, in the 90s, we had this explosion in fantastic young chefs starting up. Martin Wishart, I guess, led the way, and he opened his restaurant in Leith, and Leith was still the kind of Leith of train spotting.
Yeah.
It was a place of kind of depredation. Very poor people, lots of drugs, a kind of quite a rough area of town. And then suddenly this Michelin restaurant arrived. And on the back of that, Tom Kitchen opened there, and various other restaurants were attracted to that part of town. And suddenly Leith became where you went for a cordon bleu meal. And on the back of that, other restaurateurs thought, oh, well, maybe we can open up. So you got Mark Greenaway, and one of Tom Kitchen's friends opened up Castle Terrace, and Wedgwood, which is one of my wife and I's favourites, owned by a husband and wife team in the Canongate, opened. And sadly, because of the lockdown, Castle Terrace is no more. And the owner has had to go back to work in Tom Kitchen's kitchen again. But, you know, Tom is spreading his wings. He's opened up a few sort of bistro-type restaurants in and around Edinburgh. Mark Greenaway, I believe, is just about to open a restaurant in London. So that's an exciting thing where an Edinburgh restaurateur decides that he can open in London. So, yeah, I love it. My wife and I, the one thing that we will spend our disposable income on is fine dining. And we're so lucky that in Edinburgh, a city of 500,000 people, you really are spoilt for choice. I just hope too many of them don't go the way of Castle Terrace because of what's happened during the lockdown.
Ian, you've said before that Rebus is kind of, to an extent, your alter ego. I mean, do you share any sort of drinking or eating habits with him?
Yes, he's my Mr. Hyde and I'm Dr. Jekyll. So his eating habits are disgraceful. He's probably never cooked a meal in his adult life since he split up from his wife, God, best part of 30-odd years ago. It's, you know, it's corned beef rolls and it's takeaway food. And he until recently, smoked a packet a day, drinks too much. The lockdown has probably been very good for people like Rebus because no pubs means he can't go out and drink 6 pints a day as he's used to doing. His food is being delivered because he has health issues, so his food is delivered by his ex-colleague Siobhan, and Siobhan will be making him eat healthier food by making sure that only healthier food is delivered to his door. So, yeah, it's changed days for him. Like a lot of friends of mine in real life, he will have been losing a little bit of weight during lockdown because of the fast food restaurants, the takeaways and the pubs all being closed for a series of months. And even when the pubs reopen, I was in a pub last night, it's just not the same. It's not the same as it was. You can't stand at the bar, congregate at the bar and just talk to any stranger who comes in, which is how I used to get, you know, inspiration for stories. And that inspiration for stories is no longer there.
And what about your drinking? I mean, we know that you worked on this vineyard in France. Are you a wine connoisseur? Is that your drink of choice?
I didn't know anything about wine and barely drank any wine until I did that. So age 22, I suddenly got a taste for Bordeaux wine. And that's the only specialism I've got. If you ask me about any other kind of wine, I'm in the street that I lived in until fairly recently. It was lovely. The women started a reading group, a book group. And the men folk thought, well, that's a good idea, but we don't fancy reading books. Let's just do wine, because that's what the women tend to do, is just sit around and drink wine and talk to each other. Let's just get rid of the books, but keep in every other part of that equation. So we started a wine group, and that wine group's been going now for the best part of 15 years, and we are no better at guessing a wine now than we were 15 years ago. It's always a blind tasting. A different person hosts it every month in their home. They provide some nibbles. And at the end of the blind tasting, you go, you know, what wine you think it is, which country you think it's from, what variety, what price, etc., etc. And we are just so shoddy. It's ridiculous. And as we say, more research needed. More research needed. So we keep, you know, during lockdown, we couldn't do it, of course. But I hosted one not long before lockdown, which was great fun. But yeah, I don't know a lot about... I know a fair amount about Bordeaux. That's about it. And I know a good Bordeaux from an indifferent Bordeaux. But I'm not sure I would know any other red wine from an indifferent any other red wine.
And how about the Oxford Bar where Rebus likes to hang out? Have you been able to get there? Is it open again?
No, it's still closed as far as I know. And it's such a small bar. It's such an intimate space that I'm not sure social distancing would be possible there in any way, shape or form. And if they reopened it and suddenly found it could only take 3 or 4 people so they could socially distance, they're not going to make any money, so it's soon going to go bust. So I fear for the future of little kind of tiny bars, and there are quite a number of them in Edinburgh that have very small, snug spaces, very narrow routes that get you to the toilets and back, no beer gardens to speak of. I think there's a tough time coming for all of these places. Unfortunately, and it'd be a great loss to the city if these little intimate bars all had to go. Same goes for restaurants. I mean, some of my favourite restaurants in Edinburgh, there's one called the Little Chart Room. The Little Chart Room opened a couple of years ago in Leith Walk. I mean, it is little. And in fact, I think they have just rehomed elsewhere because I think they partly realised, well, look, this location isn't going to work for us anymore, but we've got a successful operation here. We're just going to have to find a bigger space.
And what about when you're eating at home? What is comfort food to you?
Oh, I mean, some of the stuff I've mentioned, things like chilies and curries and spaghetti bolognese are comfort food. A really good pot of soup. My wife and I tend to have soup for lunch, homemade soup for lunch. She made a really nice one yesterday that was almost kind of Mexican style with beans and chorizo in it. That was great. It was almost like a very liquid chili. Absolutely loved that. You know, I mean, if I'm writing, then I tend to just grab half an hour for lunch. And if I've had a big enough bowl of porridge in the morning, I sometimes skip lunch altogether. And then I can sort of motor on through until dinner time when we can sit and have a proper meal at sort of 6 or 7 o'clock. You know, I put snacks in front of me and I'll eat them. Put salted peanuts or crisps, Pringles, anything like that in front of me, and I'm going to hoover up the lot. So you mustn't do that, you know. I mean, you know, you think, oh, that's very good value, a 6-pack of crisps. I'll buy a 6-pack of crisps. And you go, I seem to have eaten all six of those packets of crisps in one, in one sitting. Yeah. I don't have an off switch, so I try not to turn the on switch on.
Ian, thank you so much for joining us on Table Talk. And Ian's new novel, A Song for the Dark Times, is out at the start of October.
Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website. La pauvre fleur disait au papillon céleste, ne fuis pas.